They were high school sweethearts that got married and had two kids. It's the Brunettes. From a new location, they tweet all day, but that's okay. They're the Brunettes. She is a journalist. He is a wonk.
Wonk, wonk, wonk.
They talk about the news or whatever they want. In the fight for justice, they're on your side. You can't deny it's the Brunettes.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome back to our low-effort, low-quality podcast. This is Liz Brunick. This is my husband, Matt.
Hello, everyone.
We come to you with a Q and or A app.
We sure do.
We've got your Qs. We've got some A's.
Mm-hmm. Do our best.
Whole household sick right now.
I'm coming out of it.
You think so? You think this is, or do you think this is the beginning of the long cough?
You know, that's a question. But long cough is kind of out of it.
Yeah, I mean, long cough is at least your resting state in the fall and winter months.
I'm going to be playing with the Music LM AI from Google.
Okay.
So be prepared for that.
All right.
Let's see, one of the examples here is optimistic melody about the arrival of spring, full of joy and hope, tranquil flute in the background, upbeat with a gentle guitar riff.
Nice.
Should I go with that one?
Sure.
Okay, let's see what it gives us. Carry on.
There we go. Springtime. I'm always interested in seeing what kind of sounds and smells and sights people associate with the different seasons, because I myself am a big lover of the passage of the seasons. I like all of them in their own way.
All right, well, so we just jump in?
We can just... jump right in. What lessons did you learn from high school debate that you've had to unlearn as adults? I found high school debate, I found it to be very helpful in my adult life. I know people have different takes on this, and some people have, like, I think Becca Rothfeld wrote about being in debate and so on. Some people reflect very negatively on it.
Mm-hmm. Losers.
Well, because it's hard. I mean,
losers,
it's hard, and there's a lot of pressure. And I thought that was really fun. And so I think, you know, you learn about making arguments that are convincing in debate. And of course, you can't apply the form of high school debate to arguments in your adult life. But I don't think either of us struggled with that, really.
Yeah, no. I guess the it's an intellectual exercise. It's a way of helping your mind and whatever. I guess what was her critique? Is it, I may have read it. Was it something like, it's like because you just kind of play with the arguments, it distances you from the reality of the stuff you're arguing about and makes you detached from it.
That's certainly a critique that people have. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think that's BS.
I think it was good.
BS.
Did any reporting ever come from your attempts to identify the Alabama executioners? Not yet, but stay tuned. Stay tuned.
Oh, okay. I keep hoping that'll come.
Me too. Optimal can product to make out of a surplus of persimmons and pomegranates. My mom would probably make some kind of jam out of that. You could definitely make a persimmon marmalade that's pretty good in my HO.
I don't know what persimmon is.
You don't know what a persimmon is? It's like a little orange fruit.
Is that like Bill Simmons?
It's kind of tart. Different than that. Mm. You can get them dried, especially from places like H Mart.
Purr is a name you can have in really Norway. Good.
Really? You can be named Purr?
Mm-hmm.
Per hour. What's the scariest movie you've ever seen? There's this really terrifying kind of experimental horror movie called Skinamarink. And I think it's scary because it's exactly like a child's nightmare, and you see it from the point of view of two children. But maybe I'm just unnaturally freaked out by anything happening to kids. I am very...
I've never been scared by a movie.
Troubled by that.
I can't suspend the reality enough.
What are the kids being for Halloween? Jane is being a mime. Mm-hmm. I don't know where she got into mimes, but she's very interested in them. And Claire is being a fairy.
All right.
That's what
first
I'm
hearing of that. No, I knew Jane was being a mime.
Yeah, Jane's definitely really excited about being a mime. Matt, any updates on your old critique of just war theory for being arbitrary? And what theories should we use to make decisions about wars?
Now, I don't remember saying it was arbitrary, but I did say that... maybe he's saying that the particular decision to say that you can't target civilians is arbitrary.
Yeah.
I guess, yeah, I could see, you know, I'm not gonna hone in on the language there, but the argument there was that, you know, this rule that in war you're not supposed to target civilians really originated in the 10th century, and in that period, civilians were just like farmers and like they were serfs and whatever. There was no like elected government or any notion that anything other than like kind of top level lords and whatever were involved in the management of society, war decisions, things of that nature. And then in the interim period, though, we have this notion of liberal democracy that's supposed to have changed all that. And now the government and the people are the same thing. And there was no updating of just war theory. We just continue along the line of saying you can't attack civilians because they're not involved, even though they're supposed to be the government, which is involved. And has there any update on that? Has anyone come back with a good counter-arg on that?
I don't know if anybody's figured that one out.
I would say no. In this recent flare-up, I've actually been, of course, keeping tabs on this to see how it goes. And it's very interesting. People will glimpse this argument from time to time, of course, opportunistically. That's, I guess, the problem with just war theory in general, is that people are very opportunistic in when they want to apply it and how they see its application. But you see an argument on the one hand where people will say, the Israeli civilians who were targeted, those individuals are at least within certain worldviews. What you looking at?
Nothing.
Okay.
Go on.
Liz keeps craning her whole neck over at my computer, trying to look into my DMs, see who I'm talking to.
No, I'm looking at the little thingamajig to see how much time we have.
I'm just kidding. you saw there is an argument out there that says, well, if you believe that the territory... that I guess we'd just call like Israeli territory, not counting Gaza and West Bank, belongs sort of fundamentally to Palestinians, that it's like their rightful land, I guess, in the same way that you might think certain, like the U.S. is rightfully the Native Americans or whatever, right? Mm-hmm. Then it stands to reason that people who are currently occupying it are serving a military function.
Mm-hmm.
Because they are holding down the land on behalf of the occupier. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I've seen this arg. I'm not saying I saw the arg. And what they're trying to do is just pierce through this notion of civilian immunity under just war. To say, well, they're not... Civilian immunity supposes that civilians are not involved, but if you're actually just like a chess piece on the board to hold down land, then how does that make you different from mm-hmm. a soldier? Who's a chess piece on the board to hold down land, dig the trench, hold the line. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
That's the argument people want to make. And they're just trying to pierce through that. Of course, the argument I made in the paper I published, because I'm a published scholar on this, would have focused more on the fact that, in fact, the Israeli government is an elected government.
Yeah.
And so on some level, right? They're the ultimate governing power. They put into power their representatives who have, you know, made certain decisions. And so, are they not authors of those decisions, as Hobbes would say?
Yeah.
this is none of this is to say, you know, you should throw this out. Oh, and you saw it on the flip side as well. Mm-hmm. There was a quote that was all over Twitter. It was some kind of Israeli government official or military official or something who was saying that Gazan civilians should not be immune because they have essentially allowed Hamas to govern them. They don't accuse them of like voting for them because that's not how it works, right?
Yeah.
But they accuse them of essentially acquiescing to it, not resisting the coup. Like they could topple them if they really wanted to, you know. Yeah. And so they're not doing so, and so in that sense, they are authorizing them. And of course, that would you could then say the same thing about, you know, Israelis, but then it would depend on whether you think that they're, you know, living there is a problem. You know what I mean? So
yeah.
It depends on your underlying content about who you believe, whose land it is, and that sort of thing. And then it goes to democratic governance, and then it also goes to, are you like a chess piece on the board?
Yeah.
And all these are ways to point out, which should be obvious, that in fact civilians are maybe to a diminished extent, but to some extent, of course, they are involved in the war-making process.
Yeah.
Whether because they vote for the government that makes the decisions, or whether because they are providing material support, right? Someone grows the food that soldiers eat. Someone, you know, produces the material that is used. All that kind of stuff. And yeah, to my satisfaction, I've seen a lot of stuff over the years where people are like, you can't attack because they're... And then when you're like, well, wait a minute, aren't they kind of involved like a little bit? And then... I don't really get anything back. I think the best argument you would make would kind of be to just say, hey, look, we got a good thing going here where, yeah, we don't really have a good argument for it, but we kind of got people to some extent buying this idea that you can't attack these people because they're like innocents and not involved, even though you can, yes, make this argument that they are involved in some way. But we kind of got people believing that. And it's like, it's a good thing that people believe it because it reduces, you know, the amount of atrocity or whatever.
Yeah.
On the other hand, does it? Because they still attack civilians, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Still do that.
That's true.
Maybe they do it less because of this belief, which is ultimately not well argued for.
Yeah.
But, you know. What theory should we use to make decisions about wars? I mean, I don't know. I mean, the problem, of course, with the whole enterprise is just if you had to come up with a rule about war, it would be don't do it.
Yeah.
And so they're like, yeah, well, people won't follow that rule. So why don't we suspend that and say, yeah, you can do it, but you can only do it certain kinds of ways. And then I'm like, yeah, but people won't follow those rules either, yeah, will they?
Yeah.
And they're like, they might. I mean, if we just kind of do some weak bullshit, that might be enough for people to go, okay, I won't do that. You know, I won't drop that kind of munition because it's too indiscriminate or something. You know, so.
What scary movie will you watch on Halloween? Also, candy corn, yay or nay? I like to watch Silence of the Lambs on Halloween. Candy corn, maybe a few candy corns, but it doesn't take much to max out my candy corn desire in, you know, the Halloween season. I couldn't eat like a whole bag of it. Any advice for getting married without all the rigmarole and by extension dealing with your family members who expect more than an elopement? Any other marriage-related customs you all don't abide by, e.g. rings, honeymoon, anniversaries, etc.?
I guess all of them.
Yeah, Matt doesn't.
That you listed, at least.
Yeah, Matt's never had a ring at all.
I can't deal with stuff on my hands or wrist. I know that sounds like a perfect bullshit explanation.
No, it's true, though. I saw you with the Fitbit. You couldn't handle
it because
it was a bracelet. Ugh. Yeah.
I'm sure I could get used to it, but
I've never felt like enforcing that. You don't like shit on your hands. That's fine by me. I have an engagement ring that was in my family. But that just comes from my mother. we don't really observe our anniversaries, I suppose. I'll tell you,
Oh, like, I know the summer.
Yeah,
no,
it's like
in the summer.
It's in June. It's June 27th. I'll be like, hey, you know, we've been married 9 years this year or whatever. And you'll be okay.
Yeah, I'm aware of that. I'm aware of that. But I don't need to be reminded of
yeah,
it.
Yeah, we don't celebrate them, really. You know, advice on getting married without all the rigmarole. You just gotta tell your family members to get over it and be like, look, we're not spending the money, we're not spending the time. We want to be married, not get married. And so, you know, this is the most important thing to us, starting our marriage off, you know, not in debt and not with a bunch of stress, but easy. And I think, you know, my family certainly accepted that. I will say I come from a long line of elopements. My mother eloped and my grandmother eloped. So I think this is just kind of normal in our family.
I mean, I didn't have to convince anyone.
Yeah.
I think they were surprised I was getting married at all.
That's what they told me.
Yeah. They weren't believers in me.
They just were like,
no one ever believed in me, you know? I had to come from the bottom.
Yeah.
I was a walk-on to life, you know?
What are the best scary movies that are actually kind of spooky? I like The Autopsy of Jane Doe. That's pretty good. I like The Vivitch. That's pretty damn scary. We watched it right after Jane was born and it freaked me out. You know, those are a couple ones that I like, and Skinamarink, as I mentioned earlier. What are your rules for candy rationing for the kids after Halloween? A certain amount per day, week, or as an as-earned basis? Oh, you know what's also a good kind of spooky movie is Infinity Pool, which I watched recently. I wouldn't say it's your standard horror movie, but it is pretty spooky. Liz, can you elaborate on what you meant in an earlier episode by having a chance for redemption even after death?
You didn't answer the Halloween.
Yeah, I know. That's in the same question.
Oh, okay.
Our rules for candy rationing is a certain amount per day. Yeah.
What I have done, I didn't really have a rules, but it's like, but after like a few days or whatever, they kind of just fade off and I just toss it all.
Yeah. They get over it pretty quickly.
They just don't even think about it.
Yeah.
I mean, that's kind of what I do with most. Whenever we get too much of something in the house,
yeah,
sweets wise, I'll put it up on top of the cabinet. And then if they haven't asked for it for a couple of days, I'll toss it.
Yeah, it becomes inaccessible even to me on top of the cabinet because I can't reach that.
It's interesting because it's visible, but they do just kind of lose interest in it.
Yeah, I don't think they're looking up there, even though that's where you put stuff.
Yeah, they know it's up there, but I guess maybe they're too short and they'd have to push their neck up too high.
I think that there's potential for redemption after death. I don't see why that would halt God's efforts to redeem humanity. For instance, I'm not sure hell is eternal, certainly not in all cases. You know, it might just be a season. Same thing with purgatory, you know. I think it's completely possible to be redeemed after death, and I have hope that everyone will be. Matt, do you have any insight on why the New Zealand Labour Party just got rocked so hard?
No, I don't follow New Zealand.
Okay. Can you recommend any good voices on climate? Who's the Matt Brunig of the climate issue?
No, I can't.
You don't know anybody who's doing your style of work on climate?
Climate's just such a big topic.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I'm sure there are people, but I don't know.
Somebody suggested Dr. Vox, who is now Dr. Volz.
Yeah, you know, I need to use every bit of strength in my body to just be like, okay, that maybe is true, and I need to divorce the other stupid shit he gets involved in and just say, okay, you know, maybe that's just the other stupid shit, mm-hmm. but on climate. But I don't like read day-to-day climate stuff. The only stuff I'm kind of interested in climate that I will read is like tech stuff.
Yeah,
I'm always interested in like wacky technological stuff.
Like the big carbon magnets and
this week, Sweden, they proved that they could store hydrogen in like a cave underground, like a big cave, like the size of 3 football fields or whatever. And that's they're going to use it to make steel.
Okay.
And I was like, that's pretty fucking cool. They were like, we're the first people who did it. And we did it with 3 state-owned enterprises.
Nice.
They like to emphasize that.
Nice.
I'm like, yeah, thumbs up to you guys. That's pretty cool. Now, I don't know. Are there caves everywhere? There's steel. I don't know exactly all that, but you know, you're onto something, maybe.
Matt, what are some of your best sports rule change ideas?
Oh, man, I really need to start writing these down. I used to have like 10, 20 different ideas. I got one. I was thinking about this one the other day. People like to complain about how when you fumble through the end zone, it's instead of it just being out of bounds and you get the ball back, the other team gets it like it's a touchback. And they say, oh, I think instead you should get the ball back at the 1 or something. I want to do it the other way. If you fumble the ball out of bounds, it should be a turnover and the other team gets it. Now we do have equivalents.
Okay.
You know, that, you know.
Don't you want to standardize baseball fields?
Yeah, people know about that. Definitely want standardized dimensions in baseball fields. I want the brick wall taken out in Wrigley. It's dangerous to player health, for one thing. What are some other ones? Oh, I want the NFL to experiment with sand-based surfaces.
Mm-hmm.
You know? Like, just play football on, like, sand.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think that would be good for player safety.
Yeah, better than the turf.
Yeah, the turf is terrible for player safety. And sometimes people say they want to go back to grass, but I say, why not just go all the way to sand?
That's fair.
You know?
It's hard to run in sand.
More safe. Yeah. Even more safe because it's a speed, you know, that gets you. It's sand, you know, it's cushiony. It's going to move, you know, stuff like that. Or they could just make it like a big foam pit.
Yeah. Liz, what do you believe the purpose of human existence is? I'm not a Christian, but I'm trying to be more empathetic to people I disagree with. In this case, right-wing American Christians. IMHO, capitalism, and its exploitive social relations subvert moral purpose and make humans into tools rather than creative people. How do Christians reconcile this? Yeah, you know, Christian cooperation with capitalism is fairly recent. I wouldn't read that on to the entire tradition. I think the purpose of human existence is to become perfect in love, to love perfectly, to love in increasingly elevated ways. Until you are perfect in love. And that's something that requires grace. It's not something that you can do all on your own. But I think that's what it's all about. And I think, you know, I try to orient my life towards that. Matt, when the NFL sends teams to London, why don't they make them play football soccer instead of football gridiron?
Well, you know, because they're there to play NFL football, I guess.
All right.
You know? I've heard that the turf in London is god-awful.
Yeah, it's probably real soggy.
From the rain.
Yeah, just the constant rain.
Yeah, that's the problem. They can't figure out how to get the moisture out of it.
Best and worst Halloween candy. What's your favorite?
Is there a Halloween candy, or are we just asking what the best candy is?
What's the best candy? Is it a Snickers?
You know, in the chocolate category among the generic, you know, options, yeah, it's probably Snickers. And then in the fruit category, it's probably Sour Patch.
Yeah, I like, I'm a big fan of Snickers. I like Twix a lot. Mm. I really like Kit Kats.
Mm. I don't like the like rice wafer kind of element of both of those.
I know, and that is kind of what I do like, is that they're sort of cookies. We went to the H Mart today for the fall Kit Kats, which are out now. They have chestnut and sweet potato, and also a flavor mysteriously called ice cream.
Yeah, yeah. Now, if we're allowed to branch out into exotics,
yeah,
then yeah, that definitely changes the outcome a little bit.
Yeah, send me all your country's exotic Kit Kats wherever you are.
Hi-Chews, I think
it's a good Starburst.
Yeah, They might. I don't know if they beat Sour Patch per se, but the Asian gummies, they put a lot into that. I really like that.
Yeah. I like Sour Patch. I like strawberry sour belts and sour straws, like Sour Punch. I think those are really good. Also a big fan of various types of M&Ms, especially peanut butter M&Ms, which I find really good.
Yeah, the caramel ones can be all right, too.
Yeah, the caramel ones are pretty good.
They go bad pretty quick, though.
Yeah. All good Halloween candies. Matt, can you do a consumer review of GPT-4, whatever that is?
I haven't used GPT-4 in a while. When I was using it, it was okay. I do agree with some that they do seem to have taken a step back a little bit. You know what I liked about GPT-4 was, and maybe this is not a 4 thing, but ChatGPT, over time, they added these plugins where you could do other stuff. And the thing that was really cool about it that I actually found quite a bit of usefulness in it was the ability to upload a PDF, like a long PDF, and then ask it questions about it. I could see that being very valuable, especially in a legal context. Like whenever a new Supreme Court decision comes out, if you grab the PDF from the SCOTUS website and you dump it into ChatGPT with the plugin enabled, and you can ask them questions about the decision. And I found it to be really, really good at that. And that can be, you know, so just summarization of long documents, which is, you know, a pretty generic tool that they've been promoting for a while now, like in a lot of the demos and stuff. But that's really useful, like to not have to read 100 pages in order to get, you know, the important bits out of it is very valuable in a legal context. Now, at the end of the day, I don't know, because you're always worried they're going to miss something, and so you end up reading it anyway, you know. But if over time it became very trustworthy, then I could see that being really, really useful in that context.
If you could time travel to any point in history, would you wait to eat when you got there or pack a sandwich beforehand? I'm taking a tuna salad packet. Absolutely. I'm not going to the, you know, late antiquity to eat what they have. I don't want milk-fed rat or whatever.
Tuna packet's a good idea because it lasts.
Yeah. You could take like 7 of them.
You could, yeah.
You know, because they, you know,
any kind of canned meat, really.
Yeah.
But that's probably the top tier canned meat. It's
thoughts
spam.
On Saudi Santa's new career move. This is Santa Marine. Yeah, friendship with Santa ended. Nushi is my best friend now.
I mean,
JK.
You know, she went to like the Tony Blair Institute or something like that. And obviously, Tony Blair is a shithead. But, you know, her whole, I don't know, as far as I understand it in the context, it's meant to be like a Europeanist kind of thing, right? It's like she's pro EU, pro Europe, pro, you know, like that's a big thing.
Mm-hmm.
People like to fight about, you know, is whether it should be, you know, how much of we should be focused on our national countries and how much on Europe.
Yeah.
And she, you know, so maybe one day she wants to be like in the EU Parliament or, you know, EU President or Secretary General or whatever the fuck they have. So that's how I view it. As like a stepping stone towards being an European level politician. Now she's also been doing like fashion stuff. And
yeah,
whatever.
She was at Paris Fashion Week looking amazing.
It is weird. It is kind of strange to think about what, I don't know. And maybe it's just good not to think about people's personal lives. But like, you know, like she divorced her husband and
RIP.
She has a kid and like, I don't know. What is she up to really? You know, it's kind of... It's kind of weird.
I'm about to have my second baby any day now. Any tips for navigating life with a newborn and a toddler? I'm also curious if you guys have advice for people who struggle with the problem of consumption, how you handle the spending impulse when it comes up with your kids. I definitely spend money on the kids.
I mean, that is the only thing I spend money on.
Yeah, I feel the desire to clothe them and give them toys. And I'd say, you know, we have a budget and we are moderate in that sense that we plan it. But yeah, it is hard. Navigating life with a newborn toddler, we did that, which is kind of crazy to remember. Jane was 3 when Claire was born. Definitely get a double stroller. If you live in a city that has a lot of pre-war buildings, don't get the side-by-side tandem stroller because they won't fit through all the doors and elevators. Get, you know, in-line double stroller.
Yeah. You know, I don't know that I have advice for two per se. You know, it's the same kind of stuff. Really, just get out of the house. I think that drives people nuts. And it can feel like you shouldn't because you're like, oh my God, how am I gonna? But like, yeah. just get out of the house, go to parks, whatever. I mean, I was taking, well, they were 4 and 1 and we'd hop on the train and go to New York City. And you know, I guess that's probably unusual, but I found that to be a lot, even though it's difficult, I guess in some sense, it keeps you less, you know, I don't know, you don't go crazy from being all cooped up and
yeah,
dealing with all that. And they're kind of intrigued by what's going on. And, you know, I find kids behave better outside the house than inside the house typically.
Yeah, they like stimulation. UFOs, real? Matt, what do you think?
Are they aliens? Is that the question?
Yeah, I mean, I guess we all agree there are unidentified flying objects and that there's stuff up there that we can't describe. But that could be as simple an explanation as military aircraft we are not aware of. Yeah, I don't know. I haven't seen evidence for aliens. My perspective on aliens is just if they're here, then there's no way we can contend with them because they've mastered light speed travel. So, you know, you just kind of have to accept that they're here and there are overlords and there's nothing we can do about it. But they also seem kind of averse to being noticed. They're like ghosts. They intentionally avoid being caught on camera for some reason. So, you know, I guess they're not that interested in playing a big role in human history. So yeah. I just wouldn't worry about it too much.
Yeah, I don't know if they're, I don't know if they have or haven't. I haven't seen anything definitive.
They make the argument, you know, oh, what is the likelihood that there's all this space out there and there's no other intelligent life? But I don't know, that seems possible to me.
Well, low probability things happen, you know.
Yeah, it's true. Someone sent me this thing called a female delusion calculator. And you put in all of your requirements for a mate, and it tells you...
Now, that's big in the manosphere.
It tells you how unlikely your standards are.
I've thought about doing a video on this before. Because it's bullshit.
But I did it, and you know, my chances of finding you, because I just put in descriptors of you, my chances of finding you were like... 0.00013. So low probability things do happen.
It's bullshit. Because look, it's shit like age. Like, I mean, I'll just give you a first example. Let's say you click any on all the variables.
Yeah.
And you do all the ages, 18 to 85. Okay?
Yeah.
Then they'll say that's, you get 100%, right? Because that describes all... at least men in this set.
Yeah.
I guess. I don't even know. They claim they're using live search using surveys conducted by U.S. Census Bureau and NCA. You know, what the fuck does that mean? Live search. that's troubling in its own way. But okay, so let's say we just restrict by age.
Okay.
So we say, oh, I'm a 25-year-old woman, right? Because this is for women. And I'm willing to date men who are my age or 10 years older.
Okay.
That's a pretty decent, right?
Yeah.
That's not crazy. Okay, so if we just do that, then your probability goes way, way, way down because they go, oh, well, you're excluding all the 19-year-olds and 85-year-olds. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
All the senior citizens and stuff. This one's not even working. Let me see here. God, this is just a fucking garbage. Anyways, you see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
It's stuff like that. So you got to make it conditional upon the amount of people. I'll go into it one day, but like the denominator needs doesn't shouldn't be all men, right? It should be what percent of men who are conceivably interested in you, which we would define using like normal mating patterns, right? Like you don't normally marry someone who's 60 when you're 20.
Yeah.
Right? So we shouldn't count that person in the denominator as if they are in the universe of people who you could potentially mate with. That person probably doesn't want to mate with you either. I mean, maybe some of them do. But you would pick men who are reasonably in your sort of target zone. And then the question is, what percent of them are you interested in? You see what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
And if it's the case that, okay, yeah, what's a normal range? Like 3 or 4 year age difference, you know, whatever, right? You kind of get this band of sort of men that are like in your league, quote unquote. And then the question is, what percent of them would you find acceptable?
Yeah.
Not what percent of all, you see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Like the whole thing's fucking.
It is a little whack.
It's garbage. And like, it's very easy to explain why it's garbage. And the whole manosphere just loves this thing.
Yeah.
Like, huh. That's, and you'll see them sometimes. You'll watch like TikToks and whatever where they'll go around and like do like woman on the street things.
Yeah.
And they'll like plug it in. And you'll have these ladies who are like, and they're probably bullshitting, but they're like, I don't care what their income is. And they're like, what's your minimum height? Anyone taller than me, I'm only 5'5". Okay. Like that's the vast majority of men. Whatever.
Yeah.
And he's like age and they're like, oh, you know, I'm 20. So probably like 20, 25. He's like 3%. It's only 3% of men right there.
Yeah.
Like, well, yeah. You fucking delusional bitch. It's like, what? No, that's just, you're just doing an age restriction. Of course.
Yeah.
But that's how people mate. They don't just, you know, we also don't, well, bring the children in while we're at it. I mean, put them in the denominator. Anyways.
There's a spider.
You'll be all right.
No.
Here. She's gonna flamethrow it. There you go. Okay, that didn't really work.
Hang on.
Okay.
Thank you. Terrified of spiders.
The spider was the size of a half a fingernail.
Definitely the size of my palm. What is the political usefulness of the antitrust?
Oh, I just skipped right over the autist.
Well, do you have any advice for a 31-year-old autistic male who's never had a close relationship with another person? What would your advice be?
I don't know. I just kind of lucked out, really.
You know, Matt was interested in a lot of different kinds of politics, made him easy to talk to. You know,
no, sincerely,
finding people who share your interests.
Sincerely, I have struggled to have long, close relationships period. I've been mostly unsuccessful in that respect. Liz is a weird exception to that. And you know, it's not that I don't know. Of course you read some things and they're just like men in general struggle with that.
Yeah.
So I don't know that that's, you know, maybe there's an extra dose of it, but,
in the male loneliness,
but, yeah,
maybe pickleball.
Yeah. You could do, activities, I guess. that's definitely, what you read about as, shoulder to shoulder. Right? And that thing, they go, women hang out face to face, men hang out shoulder to shoulder.
You don't look at each other?
Like they're, you know, like you're watching the game or
yeah.
Something like that.
It's true. When me and my friends hang out, we sit at the table right across from each other and just look at each other all day.
But,
you know, women are nice to look at.
I would say that I don't know strictly why. Now, well, so what have the exceptions been? when I look at the exceptions, it's been people who have been very aggressive towards me.
Yeah.
Which is welcome to some extent, obviously. I guess it depends on who is aggressive towards you. But that's really been the main breakthrough. And I think about that, and I'm like, I think, like, damn, what were these people doing exactly? Why were they so aggressive?
Yeah.
I don't know exactly. But then a lot of those people, I think about two or three people, one, to say that I don't have any interaction with any of these people anymore anyways. So, like, in a sense, they were failures, but they were temporary successes, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And these people had tons of friends. So it just seemed like they just kind of like just being friends with everyone. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so, you know, I guess if you could just find someone who's just like naturally gregarious and just really likes, you know, being friends. They were all women, though, as well.
Yeah.
I don't know what to read into that.
I think, you know, my perspective is that autistic guys are an underpriced security in the dating market. Much to love, many things to appreciate, including, I mean, the honesty, the straightforwardness. I kind of appreciate the no can't, no bullshit style of communication that autism seems to necessitate.
But activities is another piece of it.
Yeah.
I think because... In each of the cases, it was, well, yeah, and in almost all the cases where it's been like debate or something like that. Debate was a weird, you know, jumping off point. But, yeah, I guess if you just do things where you just have to be around people for long periods of time, especially long periods of downtime, you know, that can work. Of course, it's easier when you're younger, I guess.
Well, my friend Sarah has suggested in the Patreon comments thread this Catherine Project, which holds online seminars on great books and other classics for free, which sounds pretty great if you're a humanities-oriented person. That sounds like a good way to meet someone who's into talking what you're into, talking about what you're interested in talking
okay,
about.
Okay, yes. So getting involved in a book club, essentially.
Yeah, I think that makes sense.
Yeah. No, because that's a version of what I guess I'm talking about. Yeah. I guess that's advice people give.
Yeah.
But the struggle... the struggle here is like... is a desire for the connection, but then also like the practice of doing it being just not just like hard, but like actually sucks.
Yeah.
Like actually like you just get all anxious and all just completely riled up. And so it's like you don't, you know, it's like I want it, but I also don't.
Yeah.
You know, and that's a tough dynamic. Maybe he can relate to that where yeah. you're like, oh, well, sitting alone, like in the abstract, I still have that base human desire. But when it goes to trying to implement it, that's a real rough thing. Like, can't, you know, formulate what I'm thinking. I draw blanks. I get nervous. I get, you know, and then you're like, oh, and then all you want to do is not do that. You know, mm-hmm. That's a, you know. I feel like, you know, autism should also just zap that underlying human desire. That's the thing people aren't thinking about. They always want to solve the how can you make the connection. What if just solve the desire to have the connection?
Yeah.
You know? What if we could just fix that? That'd be a big win.
Yeah.
But we can't.
Yeah.
Not yet.
You got to take the, you got to start taking the adrenaline blockers.
Yeah, you told me that there was some study where they were taking people who had social anxiety, I guess, which I guess is what this is, and just making sure that just putting adrenaline blockers in them, and then they were chill, and they were able to. What was it like? Because a lot of it is like you just literally can't think of what to say.
Yeah,
and you also just don't hear them because you're so amped up. Like, you hear them, but it's, like, in one ear, out the other. So, you both draw a blank, and also, you're just like, I don't really know what you just said for the last minute.
Yeah.
I fucking don't even know. So, now I'm really fucked. Because where do I go from here?
You can just be like, come again, sorry.
But could you repeat all of that? And I'm going to close my eyes while you do it.
Yeah.
Okay.
I think that's fair. You know, I think autism is something that more and more people are talking about and coming to understand. So hopefully it won't be that big of a barrier. I don't think there's anything wrong with being autistic.
There's a lot of things wrong with it.
You know, but for me, I don't find it to be difficult to be in a relationship with someone who's dealing with this autism. You know, I like you just the way you are. Any political usefulness to the antitrust small business people? What do you think?
Maybe. I mean, there's always overlap with any group, even if they're have misguided underlying motivations, right? That's the whole overlapping consensus idea.
Yeah.
So, I mean, to give a concrete example, the antitrust small business people are very anti non-compete clauses.
Yeah. So they can be in a coalition around that.
Right. And their motivations for it have to do with like market efficiency and things of that nature. At least a lot of them do. But there is a more old school, just kind of pro-labor perspective that says that this is, you know, non-compete clauses are just really make life hard for workers. They just disempower workers generally, which occurs not just because it makes it so they can't quit, but if and then go like immediately make money and maybe make more money by going somewhere else, but also it makes it hard for them to negotiate. It makes them worried about being fired. It makes it hard for them to organize. I mean, that's the whole reason the NLRB has taken up the non-compete cause, is not because they're worried about the efficiency of markets and how we need more competition in order to, you know, not that. It's just that these clauses function as like, they functionally just throw cold water on workers who want to organize and assert themselves in the workplace.
Yeah.
Because their outside options are so limited when they're subject to it. So, you know, with any group like that, I think, you know, you distinguish between their underlying philosophies, which may be misguided and may diverge from your own. And that's, I think, important to keep in mind. But misguided philosophies can generate right answers for the wrong reasons.
Yeah.
But right answers are still welcome and worth working with someone to pursue.
Any takes on giftedness, gifted and talented, twice exceptional kids, etc.? Pulling kids out for gifted and talented teaching, yada yada. You believe in any of that?
I've read some of this stuff that he's talking about where they'll say this doesn't actually help the kids who are gifted and talented, right? Like,
yeah.
The logic here is you have someone, I mean, I think now about our own kids, right? I think about Jane. Jane is, I don't think I'm going too crazy here if I say that she is mathematically gifted,
mm-hmm.
at least at this age, right?
Yeah, I wonder like, where she gets it.
She wants to talk about math in the car. I've taught her a lot of math just driving. Like, we'll just drive places and she wants to know about math. And I'll tell her, I was like, oh, you know, here's algebra. And the way that so they're still doing like adding and mm-hmm. like coins and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And she knows how to multiply like any digit, you know, 1 to 9 to 1 to 9. Like, she knows that whole thing. And not through times table or whatever, but just like, she just kind of does it by, you know, in her head. Learned all that in the car because we go on these long drives when we go and do shit on the weekends, and she's always interested in that. And then to teach her division, I actually taught her like the basic algebra stuff. Like, you know, we started with, you know, 5 + x = 8, and then explained to her, you see what we're trying to do here, and oh, x = 3. And then showed her, you know, you can actually do that with multiplication as well, right? 5x = 20. And what we're saying here is 5 × x = 20. So what is that? And she'll do it. It's 4. Okay. And that's from there. I'm like, you know, division is just the opposite of that. So like, what would 20 divided by 5 be? Oh, it's 4. Anyways, she can do, it's, I find it wild. And apparently if you look at what they're supposed to be able to do, they're not supposed to be able to do that until like well, that shit maybe until sixth, seventh grade. But even just multiplication is apparently a fourth grade thing.
Mm-hmm.
And she's already got all that. And so the question is just like, would she be more benefited if she was in a class that was doing multiplication right now?
Mm-hmm.
And intuitively you think, well, yeah, of course, right? Because like, she already knows all the math that's being taught to her right now. She's way ahead. And so like, she could be spending that time on other math. But that's not really what they find. At least yeah. there's research that suggests that's not really what they find. So I don't know.
Yeah, I don't think there's any arguing with the fact that some people have native talent. And, you know, I certainly support them pursuing that in whatever way possible. But I think there are other ways to do it aside from pull-out programs that take the kids out of class and exclude yeah. other kids. Like
the question, yeah, is there an issue of time allocation where if you reallocated the time that she's using on math she already knows towards pushing the boundaries of the where she's at, the boundaries of where she's at on her math knowledge, would that be better? And I don't know. Like I said, it seems like it would be, but then at the same time, she's learned all this shit without spending any time on it in class.
Mm-hmm.
And not really through like, well, I'm spending a lot of time drilling her on it or whatever. Like, it's just like conversations in the car. And I guess the other thing is like, at the end of the day, you are only learning a certain amount of math in high school or in your, you know, K through 12. And so is there a lot of value in like learning that all by like 10th grade and then being done? There's some kind of dispute going on.
Yeah. One moment.
I'll pause.
I've been getting back into Shakespeare again recently. Thoughts on the Bard? Any of his work you particularly love or hate? Yeah,
oh, it's all boring. All sucks.
I'm a big fan of Shakespeare. I especially like Hamlet, which is kind of normie. But the what a piece of work is man, how noble in reason, how infinite in faculty, in form and moving, how express and admirable in action, how like an angel in apprehension, how like a god, the beauty of the world, the paragon of animals. That monologue is meaningful to me. Plus, I find Hamlet quite relatable.
What Halloween candy will you give out? My husband and I are not in agreement on quality, quantity, / candy type. I have two ideas on this.
Mm-hmm.
One is, I guess, the usual route, which, right, you just go to Costco and you get the Costco full bars or whatever.
Yeah, I love doing that.
We don't really get a whole lot of visitors, so it's really not that expensive.
Yeah.
But I'm also tempted to go to the regular grocery store and buy it with the EBT.
Okay.
In order to upset people.
Okay.
Say, look, I just used my EBT to buy Halloween candy.
Yeah, very nice.
Because as I mentioned a few episodes, we got a pandemic EBT card with $120 on it for Jane. I've only spent $40 of it.
Favorite autumnal movies that aren't horror, spooky, Halloween oriented. The Ice Storm by Ang Lee. Love that one. Takes place over Thanksgiving weekend. Very good one. Do you do anything special for the Little Bakery on Halloween night? I haven't in the past. I don't want people to feel like I'm pressuring them to take something homemade. We get a lot of people on Halloween who aren't from the neighborhood and wouldn't necessarily know that I do this frequently. But I might do something for it this year.
Yeah, we'd probably have to light it up if we were going to do that. That's an interesting idea.
Liz, do you have a take on what exactly Twitter does to people's brains? You know, I think it's fine. I think it's a lot like the conditions that lead to road rage. Like you're all by yourself and you're just kind of imagining the person you're mad at. And so you imagine the worst possible version of them, and then proceed to get, extremely angry. So I think, you know, small slights seem bigger and, just kind of breakdowns in communication are easier on Twitter. But I think it's fully recoverable. I quit Twitter and I got on Blue Sky briefly, but I just didn't have it in me anymore. I just don't really want to post and I don't don't find the posting habits I used to have.
Yeah, I don't post that much
to
either.
To be good or productive, anymore. So.
I think I know exactly what happens because I've seen so many people deal with it. It's that if you're a bigger account, you have a lot of people. You don't have a lot of people. Objectively, it's a small number of people, maybe a few dozen. Maybe if it's real crazy, you know, you could get up to even 100 or something. Often they are mutual followers. They see each other. They're sort of not working together in an explicit sense, but they see one another and they, right? You overblow what they are doing, and it feels like, and this is, I feel like, just a basic human instinct, like we're not evolved to deal with this. It feels like the whole world is mad at you. It feels like everyone is looking at you and shunning you and pointing their finger at you, when in fact it's like a few dozen people who mostly know each other anyways. And then that can get you in a spiral of, you know, dislike. Oftentimes, among the criticisms, there's at least some fraction of it that's just wildly false. And so now you're getting even more upset, and you start attributing that to people as well, is all the false things that you're hearing. And then you view those as like, this is a whole segment of society that I'm contending with. This represents whatever it might be, the right, the left, the, you know, Hillary, the Bernie, whatever. And all of this is just driven by, in fact, just a few dozen people interacting with you. And then, of course, on your timeline itself, not just in your mentions, people who say stupid shit end up getting very, you know, you frequently will get that in your timeline, especially if you have like an algorithmic timeline. But even if you don't, because people like to highlight when people say stupid stuff, and because, you know, they want to nutpick the craziest stuff from their opponents and whatever. And, you know, that can drive you crazy if you are just not prepared to be like, okay, this is really dumb. Like, I had an example of this just a few days ago.
Mm-hmm.
And this was a crazy one, because normally you see random people. Like, the fact that someone, some random person who you don't know, just some low follower shit account, has misattributed something to you, or screenshotted some small part of an article that is actually, you know, in isolation looks to be saying something that's very different from what you're actually saying, and whatever, right? That's just nonstop. And especially with headlines and stuff, which you don't even get to write if you're publishing it somewhere else. That's something you come to expect, and it's whatever. But I had actually a prominent person, Brad Wilcox, who from time to time pretends like he's like, I'm with you guys, I'm right. Like, he's DM'd me before and been like, this was a good piece, can we put it over at, what's the website they do? Like Family Studies or something like that. And I'm always like, no, you can't do that.
Okay.
Why would I do that? I don't know. Well, exposure, yeah. I've got plenty of exposure. He put out a thing where he goes, I'm witnessing a strange new development. And he had someone do this, like, he obviously had to pay someone, like, you know, it's some kind of professional graphics guy. Mm-hmm. He goes, many on the far left and red pill right are now disparaging marriage and discounting its value for men. And he puts this quote in here that he's attributing me that says, marrying an upper class spouse is privilege enhancing while marrying a lower class spouse is not. But the actual sentence is, if we follow Douthat's recommendation to look at the behavior of upper-class people to determine what kinds of behavior are privilege-enhancing, then we are forced to conclude that marrying an upper-class spouse is privilege-enhancing while marrying a lower-class spouse is not and should be avoided. That's how upper-class people actually behave, right? So it was my take on Douthat's take. Yeah. I was saying, this is what Douthat's reasoning says. He says, look at what upper class people do. Well, what do upper class people do? They sure as hell don't marry lower class people.
It's true.
So if we want to say, let's use them as exemplars for our behavior, well, what does that tell you? It tells you avoid the lower class like the plague. You want to see what the lower class does in the marriage markets. They're like, you think that lower class people think lower class people are unmarriageable. Talk to an upper class person. They for sure think that. And so it was, I'm describing how upper class people think about marriage.
Yeah.
It's my account of how they think about it. It's not my account of it. It's not how I think about it. It's how I'm saying that's how upper class people think about it. And he just says, this is what Matt thinks. And like, it's just 100% clear that that's not true. And, you know, you issue a correction. You know, you send it to him. And, you know, he doesn't take it down. No one ever quits with it. And you just, but, you know, you could get pissed. Imagine if you're just getting that over and over and over and over again.
Yeah.
Which is what a lot of people do get on there. But, you know, I just, this is wrong. This is dumb bullshit. And then I just move on. And I'm sure, you know, hundreds of people saw a quote that's not actually my quote, you know?
Yeah.
That's not actually something I think that he's put like by a picture of me and whatever. And yeah, what does that do to your brain? It's easy to see how that could drive someone fucking nuts.
Any other book ideas for you, Liz? Yeah, I think I want to put together a book of essays on love and forgiveness. Shout out in the comments whether you would like that. Is Matt ever going to write his blueprint user guide for the perfect welfare state? Are you going to put it all in book form?
Yeah, maybe when the kids get older. I'm having motivation issues.
Yeah, I think that's illness.
Could be. I'm not eating as much as I used to. I don't know. I'm trying to figure out physiologically why I can't be as productive as I once was.
Why do we enjoy being scared? Augustine writes in his Confessions about how perverse it is to enjoy tragedies in the theater we wouldn't enjoy experiencing or watching in real life. Does he have a point in re-horror movies or haunted houses? I think, you know, Halloween is a good holiday and spookiness is a nice theme because everybody has to deal with ultimately the fear of death, which is the fear that underpins all of the spooky movies, spooky houses, etc. And everybody's got to deal with their mortality. And it's not even a bad thing to consider your mortality, I don't think. But Halloween and the spooky season kind of presents a way to do that in a less terrifying way, paradoxically, than you know, encountering your mortality for real. So I think it's okay. I don't think it's morally bad. I think it has a lot in common with sort of Memento Mori iconography. You know, I see all the skeletons around town around Halloween and I just think, oh yeah, Memento Mori, this is a centuries old theme. I don't think it's a bad thing.
Could socialism in the U.S. be done at the state level? Not an American, so please excuse the dumb question. So it's going to depend on what you mean by this. I will analyze it in three areas, which are the three areas I tend to focus on, though I don't think they're all socialism, really. Mm-hmm. But they're relevant to sort of the broader social democratic thing, right? You've got the labor market, you've got the welfare state, and then you've got public ownership of capital.
Mm-hmm.
The labor market, there are things states can do to make the labor market more worker-friendly. States are allowed to have their own minimum wage laws. Most of the federal laws regarding like wage and hour, overtime, what's the other stuff like vacation, holiday, all that kind of stuff in the labor market, those are like floors.
Yeah.
And states are allowed to go beyond them and pass rules that go beyond them. But when it comes to the overall organization of the labor market, like how workers organize into unions and stuff like that, there are little things you can do around the edges, some wiggle things. It was actually, I put out a piece at People's Policy Project written by Nick Warino earlier this week, or maybe it was last week. It's about California and sector bargaining.
Mm-hmm.
And there's like some things you can do around the edges, but ultimately the National Labor Relations Act is the federal, you know, framework for unionization and worker representation and stuff. And if you, a state can't do it, has to be very careful with not conflicting with that, or even going beyond it, because there's this thing called machinist preemption and Garmin preemption, and basically the federal structure reigns supreme. So states are limited by what they, by the fact that there is a federal statute, that they can't just create, you know, a sector union type system per se. Now there are little things you can do to try to get around it and model something similar to that. And some states have done that with these things called wage boards and whatever, but they are very limited. With the welfare state, I think states have a much freer hand than many people seem to think. And that's this long report I'm working on for Washington State is basically focused on that. We've seen some state movements on this recently with free school lunch. But there's no reason in principle a state could not have public health insurance. We've seen paid leave, though the paid leave has been shittily designed, unfortunately. But that's been going across states. The states could improve, could provide supplemental benefits for the elderly, the disabled. You could have state-level child benefits. All that could be done on a state level. There are some issues with, for example, the food stamp program and the Medicaid program are like state federal. The UI program also has federal components. So we have this like, there are parts of the welfare state that are these mixed state federal programs, and states are limited in what they can do to those programs to make them better because they have to abide by the federal rules that are part of the state federal structure. So, you know, yes and no on that one. State ownership of capital, that one they really have a free hand in, and you can do stuff. We see state-owned enterprises, you know, idiosyncratic state-owned enterprises. You can see them across the country. There are municipally owned grocery stores in a handful of cities and counties. There is a state-owned bank in North Dakota people like to talk about. Alaska obviously has its Alaska permanent fund, which is cool. In LA, I think they have a city-run health insurer called LA Health. I think that's what it's called. You know, there are plenty of publicly owned utilities, like water, electricity, things like that. And obviously, you've got the slate of publicly owned services, which are mostly done on a local level, not a state level, but a state could do it as well, right? So police, fire, schools, libraries, all that stuff is done, you know, through direct public administration. Those aren't state-owned enterprises, but we call them general government services, but they're organized publicly. So that's something states have a much freer hand in, and they could. You could have a state that really tried to push the envelope on state-owned enterprises and publicly owned wealth. And I think in state like Alaska, you've actually seen them do that. So there's potential on the state level, certainly. But people are not that interested in state politics, and you know, taxes are always an issue, and you know how it goes. So,
well, I think that's about all the time we have for today. But we'll get to more of your Q's and A's. Maybe next episode we'll throw in a few more Q's and A's from this list.
All right.
Thanks, guys.
Adios, mofo.